Welcome to the SBS Digital Learning Hour, brought to you by the Digital Learning and Assessment Department. We're coming to you today from a conference room and central office, bringing you the latest news in Springfield Public Schools in regards to technology, along with inspiring interviews from teachers who are using technology in the classroom. I'm your host today, Mike Thomas, the Bearded Tech Ed Guy. You can find me out on all the socials at Bearded Tech Ed, my personal website, beardedtechedguy.com, and of course, the Digital Learning page on My SPS. As we continue about this summer, we've only got a few weeks left, and so we're going to try to wrap up this series on the distance learning playbook. Now, if you've been following us for the past few weeks, we've been going through module by module. For this week, we're actually going to cover a couple modules at the same time because, well, we want to finish before the school year starts, and that's not going to happen if I don't double up at some point. So the reason we're doubling up for these two, because Module 6 is all about engaging tasks, and Module 7 is all about planning instructional units for distance learning. Now, we are in person, and for many of us, we want to forget that time of remote learning because it was really hard. But there was a lot of great things that we learned and learned how to do and were able to accomplish in our classroom. And a lot of those things revolved around the different tasks and the units that we were doing. So that is why, for this week, we're combining the two modules because I think they go hand in hand. Because when you go to plan your unit, you want to make sure that you're planning engaging tasks. And if you're in person, the same things apply. And I think that's what's fantastic about this distance learning playbook is that the same things apply whether you're in person or remote or hybrid or concurrent. They all are very applicable to each other. So at the beginning of Module 6, during these engaging tasks, the authors argue that for the tasks that are engaging and relevant to students' interests are more likely to lead to learning. And I think this is true no matter what. I can think of lessons that I knew that I was delivering that were dull and kind of ho-hum, but I knew I needed to be engaging with them, even though I was following this curriculum map that I didn't necessarily agree with. And so for me, the tasks that go along into these lessons that were dull and ho-hum really needed to be engaging. Engagement is at the core of learning. When students are disengaged, a lot of times we end up getting them labeled with either being unmotivated or they're a behavior problem, when the reality is for many of them, they're just not engaged in whatever you're doing. And this can have a large effect on the overall classroom. Now, since this book is focused on distance learning, I am going to point out some of the distance aspects of this. When students are unengaged, they're going to be, you know, turning their cameras off. They'll be using two monitors. You can't see me air quoting here, but I'm air quoting two monitors. Or one of their monitors is their Xbox on their TV. So it looks like that they're engaged, but they're not really engaged because they're doing something completely different. Now, luckily, when we are in person, students don't have their TVs and their Xboxes or their animals or their neighbors or their parents right there with them. They're in the classroom with you. That is one way that you're already ahead of the curve on creating engaging tasks. A couple of things the book points out is that there's a few different types of engagements. One is behavioral engagement, and this is the one that most of us kind of think about when we're thinking about students' engagement in class. If they're behaving, then they are engaged in the class. You and I both know that that is not true. And if you're a new teacher out there listening, just because the students are listening and compliant doesn't mean that they're engaged. And I think that is a big perception that we struggle with as teachers because we could think things are going well because students are engaged because they're not being disruptive. Do you see the logical flaw that just happened in my sentence there? Students can be behaving, but not be engaged in the learning. So that's one thing they point out. Another is cognitive engagement. Now they're talking about the psychological effort students exert to master contents. Observable actions include planning, monitoring their own progress, setting goals, problem solving. You know, some of the things that we want our students to be able to do independently of us. We want them to be able to plan their work. We want them to be able to set goals. I know here in Springfield, in our portrait of a graduate, we're really working on students having a lot of autonomy in their learning. And to have that autonomy, they need to be able to monitor their progress. They need to set goals and they need to problem solve. Another type of engagement that they start out talking about in this section is emotional engagement. And it's the affective dimension of learning. Interest and relationships contribute to a student's ability to learn, Learners who have a sense of belonging and an affinity towards their classmates are more likely to be engaged. I think about this when it comes to discussions, because if students are not engaged emotionally in the classroom, they're not going to partake in the discussions. They're not going to pose questions when they don't understand something, because there's something going on with them that is blocking them from being engaged. What I really like, and if you've got the same book that I do, on page 104, they've got this really great continuum that goes from active to passive to active and from one side to the other with disengagement and engagement. So on the far end of disengagement is disrupting. It's an active act to be disruptive, but you're also disengaged because they're not learning and they're also distracting others. At the other end of this disengagement is withdrawing, and that's closest to being passive. Because when we withdraw, we are not actively participating in the class, but we're also not causing others to be distracted. We might be distracted. We also, I think of being like a wallflower, and this kind of withdrawing is a passive disengagement. And I do this personally when I go to parties. I'll talk to people for a little while, and then I'll kind of go and sit off on my own, because I need to disengage because that's just my personality. For some students, that is part of their personality. And so as a teacher, you need to be acutely aware and be able to reach those students when they are withdrawing. Because what you want to do is get them back to from withdrawing to participating. One step at a time is what it takes to get them to be actively engaged in the lessons. So if you got them doing work, you're getting that process started, but you're not fully there, because what you want to see them doing is setting their own goals and doing some self-assessments and seeking some feedback. So with all of this, the authors provide a number of strategies for creating engaging tasks, which includes the functions of their engagement. What are you trying to achieve with the students? What are you trying to help them learn new content or practice skills or apply their knowledge to real-world problems? And again, all good lesson plans start at this point. You're looking at the standards and you're figuring out what you need your students to be doing. Another part of this is setting up your classroom for success. When you're remote, that's figuring out how to reinforce that the students need a dedicated learning area. We talked about this back at the very first module, because the students needed, and you need, a dedicated space for learning. When you're in person, this one's pretty easy. It's your classroom. But then you got to think about the layout of your classroom. You got to give them spaces where that they can collaborate with their peers. You got to make sure that when you're setting your room up for success, that there's not too many things that would be distractions for them. And then when they are working, you need to make sure that you are giving them clear instructions and clear expectations, so that they can interact and do the things that they need to do. Another thing that they talk about is the tools, and I'll cover a lot of these different type of tools that can help create engaging tasks that students will be able to do in the classroom using their computer for help in learning. One of the things that gets really pointed out is that the medium, that is the way that the thing the students are using, doesn't matter as much. Because students can go from interacting with information verbally to paper and pencil, and then they could do interpretive dance. That's one of the things the book points out. I was never an interpretive dance type person. I never really did that with my class, but I could see how that could be helpful. But the idea is that there's a lot of tools to share learning. And if you want to engage your students, you need to give them the opportunity to use a lot of these tools. Some of the tools that could be used are like Quizlets and Kahoots and Padlets, MindMeisters. I've never really used those myself, but it's something you can use. Flipgrids, OneNote. If you have PlayPosit, we don't here in Springfield, but if you did, you could use that. Edpuzzle is something similar. Now, if you want to get them to where they're sharing that information, they could be doing PowerPoints. They can be doing Wii videos. You can use Storybird. So there's lots of tools that you can use for helping them creates opportunities for engagement, whether it's for finding information, using information, creating that information themselves, or even just sharing that information. And all of this to say is that when it comes to having engagement, you need to select the tools that meet the needs of the students. If you're having students practice their reading, you might not necessarily have them do an interpretive dance because they, need to read. But you might could use something like Flipgrid or Reading Progress in Microsoft Teams, which allows your students to practice that reading in ways that they can get immediate feedback for. One of the things that I think of when I'm thinking of engagement, and that in thinking about all the ways that I've learned in the past and from my years of experience of teaching, I think of there's four main functions of that engagement for students and for it to be successful. One is it needs to be motivating. You need to have tasks that motivate students to learn. They provide students with a reason to want to learn the content and to do their best work. Having motivation really makes a big difference for the students' learning, and it helps with their engagement. You need comprehension. Engaging tasks help students understand the content. They provide students with the opportunities to interact with the materials in a meaningful way. And again, I go back to, if I'm doing something that focuses on some reading skills, I don't necessarily need to have them do a dance because they need to comprehend what they're reading. Another function of engagement is retention. Engaging tasks help students retain the content, provide the students with opportunities to practice what they've learned, and apply it in real-world problems. I think that's the most important thing here, is having students have the ability to work on real-world problems. You and I both know of times where we said it when we were in school, oh, I'm never gonna use this in the real world. The reality is, you probably are, you just don't know it, because it's gonna be so ingrained into you on whatever you are learning that you think that you might not need. And having that quick retention allows you to apply and solve problems. Being a problem solver is an incredibly important skill in the real world. Having that knowledge from the engagement, which helps retain that knowledge, is extremely vital. And then the last one that I can think of as a function of engagement is the idea of a transfer. Engaging tasks help students transfer what they've learned to new situations. This comes back to that problem solving again. So really, retention and transfer, both of them kind of work together, because students need to be able to have opportunities to use their knowledge and skills in different contexts, in different ways to problem solve, so that they see how things are connected. And so when we're thinking about engagement, we want to make sure that we have clear conditions with that engagement. We need to make sure that we set up the students for success. And this includes providing students with clear instructions. Students need that so they can complete the task successfully. If the instructions that you are giving the students are not clear and concise, they're going to get lost. And that is going to affect their engagement, because if they're lost, they're going to become disengaged. You kind of see how the ball rolls here. Students need opportunities to collaborate with their classmates. Students tend to learn more when they are working with their classmates. When they work together, they share ideas, they help each other, they learn from each other. And one of the things I always did when I was teaching was I tried to have this rule of three and then me. Ask three of your classmates first, and if all of you are not able to work it out, then come to me, and come to me as a group, because then I can work with all of you at once. This idea of collaborating to gain your learning is vital. And students need that. They need those opportunities. When we're in distance learning, like the book talks about, that is a bit more difficult, because if I wanted to do that three and then me, they would have to bounce around to various rooms that are set up in Teams or Zoom. And that is extremely difficult. I don't know about you, but I always tended to get lost when I was trying to go from room to room when I was remote. And then one other condition that I think is vital for engagement is making sure that the tasks that the students are doing are challenging, but not too difficult. Tasks that are challenging tend to be more interesting, but if they're too challenging, students will become frustrated and then become disengaged. If tasks are too easy, students become bored. I mean, if you've been a teacher for any length of time, when the work is too easy, students blow through it, and then they're sitting there wondering, like, what am I doing now? And so that's where, as a teacher, you need to make sure that you are able to adjust what you are doing. A few of the questions inside the book that I really liked that if I were doing lesson planning now that I'd be asking myself are what learning function does the tool provide? Is it developmentally appropriate for my students to use with minimal adult assistance? Like, I'm not going to give a fifth grader Camtasia and say, here, make a video with Camtasia, because that's way above what they need. They need some coaching to get there. And does this tool have accessibility features that are aligned to digital compliance requirements? Like, for example, closed captioning, screen reader software, immersive reader, and knowing what those things are. And again, I love that the book has so many resources. I know I put them in the show notes for the episode here. But again, you can get, they have a whole lot of handouts and printouts and PDFs that you can fill in yourself as you are teaching. And that can help you with organizing the tools that you're using to create engaging learning tasks. Another important thing to do is whenever you're creating a task for the students to do, you need to have engagement in mind. You need to be able to encourage students to think in more than one way by transforming tasks from closed to open tasks. This is a couple of things that the book is pointing out here on page 111. One of the really things that as a teacher you need to think about is there more than one entry point into this task for the students? And we think about when it comes to problem solving, is there only one way to solve the problem or is there multiple ways? And that's in something as you're designing your tasks for your students you should be thinking about. And then the idea of taking information and having it connect and relate. It's one thing for students to be able to regurgitate. It's another thing for students to connect something from one subject or one area that they've learned about to another. Another thing I like that the book points out is asking students what they think first rather than telling them what they need. This will allow students to kind of have that mindset where they can explore. A lot of times, and I saw this with my fifth graders, is they just want you to tell them what to do. They don't want to think first for themselves. And so I know I worked really hard with that. I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if it's because of they're just fifth graders and prior years they were just told what to do and given less autonomy. I don't think so, because I worked with a lot of fantastic teachers who were teaching at those younger grades, and I don't think that it came from there, but I have no idea. One of my favorite quotes that I pulled from this book over the last few years was actually on page 111, where it says, learning remotely doesn't need to be reduced to completing endless amounts of worksheets. And I actually would modify that to say, learning doesn't need to be reduced to completing endless amounts of worksheets. I know for a lot of teachers, especially when you're first starting out, there's a lot of worksheets that get done. I know that there's been times when I've tried to go to the copier and teachers were printing out worksheet upon worksheet for the students to do. And there's a lot more to education than just some worksheets. And the last thing I want to talk about in this module 6 is there's a section of it, and it's called figure 6.4, and it's this idea of a learning menu. Now, it's focused for at home, but I am a big proponent of using a learning menu in the classroom, giving students options on how to display their learning, how to show their learning. And what's really cool is every day there's different tasks that they show for the students to be doing. So like Monday, if what they're supposed to be doing is something with sunflowers and Van Gogh's birthday, there's shared discussion, letter sounds, math, gross motor, art or sensory or fine motor, and students can pick from that. I love menus or choice menus or whatever you feel like calling it. Giving students the ability to choose in their learning makes a huge difference. I know when it came to students reading at home, I know this was always a big thing for me, is if I was giving homework, one of the only things I really ever wanted to do was have them read at home and then complete a task. And I would give them a 3x3 sheet with 9 different exercises on it using different learning modalities that they had to do. And every week they had to get 3 in a row, tic-tac-toe. With giving the students the ability to choose what they're doing, they're going to be more engaged. And if each of those things are on that tic-tac-toe board, different things to accomplish, that gives them different ways to do their learning and to demonstrate what they've learned. I had a few different versions of the tic-tac-toe, and students would never get the same one in the course of a month. So I had 4 different versions. with the boxes all laid out differently. Students always had to get three in a row, however they wanted to do it. And so that kind of helped make sure that students weren't doing the same three things over and over again. And it forced them to choose differently. Now, like with all modules, I like to wrap up the module with the success criteria. And of course, I'm going to change the wording just a little because we are in person and not necessarily learning distance. But before I do that, I want to make sure that I, again, reiterate, engaging tasks are essential for learning. When students are engaged in their work, they're more likely to learn. By thinking about the functions of engagement, setting up the conditions for engagement, and using the right tools, teachers can create engaging tasks that will help their students learn. And they can see this when they look at the success criteria. I can design tasks that move students from doing to driving. I can describe the function for which I will select the learning tool. I can evaluate the tools for their usefulness. I can use the task design principle in this book to help with all my learning situations. And I can develop and implement a considerate schedule. To know that you are being successful in the classroom is to be able to answer these questions in the positive. A few other things with engaging tasks before we leave this module. I think it's important to be using a variety of instructional methods. You can go from doing your 5-minute lectures to discussions to group work to individual assignments to flips to students creating their own Nearpod. Students making and using different multimedia, like making videos or infographics or doing images or drawing. Students need opportunities to also reflect on their learning. And that's one way that you can find out if the tasks that you've been giving are engaging, because when students are reflecting and writing up their reflection or delivering it through a flip, you'll be able to tell pretty quickly, was this an engaging task? Was it appropriate for my students? And by doing all these things, you can make sure that your classrooms are more engaged. Like what you heard so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show. Like I said at the beginning of the podcast, we're actually going to talk about Module 7 at the same time because I do think the two kind of go hand in hand. This idea of planning instructional units for your learning. Throughout this section of the book, throughout this module, the authors argue that planning lays the foundation for a successful learning experience. And quite frankly, when I was reading about that and I kind of came to that conclusion, I just wanted to smack myself in the head and be like, duh, if I am not properly prepared, my students are not going to be engaged in their learning. See, that's how we start to connect it. And when it comes to planning units, you always think of the end in mind and do backwards design. Teachers need to clearly define what they want students to learn and know by the end of the units. And then by knowing those things, they can then plan backwards to get the students there. And then even when it comes to planning units, it's important, I think, and this is what I always did, which I would try to break it down into smaller chunks. Like, there's multiple parts to a unit. By breaking it down, it's manageable to do the planning for. Whenever I struggled when it came to planning in the classroom, it would be because I would see the end goal. I would have that. And then I would try to design the entire thing backwards instead of taking a breath and thinking about, are there 4 or 5 parts to this? What are those parts? And then planning each one of those parts and going backwards. Sometimes, and I think this might be true for all of us, is when we have the end in mind, we try to immediately plan the entire thing, when I think it's much better to plan in manageable parts, because that will allow you to be more effective in your instruction. And it also makes sure that your students grasp all the content, all the concepts, before moving on. When it comes to the backwards design of planning and thinking about your entire unit, you need to be thinking about the needs of your students. Understanding their strengths, their weaknesses, and interests will help you tailor your units to meet the students, and it will help improve the engagement, and it will give the students more meaningful learning experiences. When we choose the right tools and resources, we give the students the ability to excel. With a wide array of options available As a teacher, you got to consider what your students' needs are and the goals of the unit, and then selecting the appropriate tools to get there. For example, I can think of, if you want your students to demonstrate their learning through coding, what does it take to get there? Is that something that you need to do during this unit, or do you need to do a separate unit beforehand on teaching them how to code and using things like code.org and Scratch? Depending on the type of assignment, that might not be appropriate. That might not be a good use of your time or the student's time. And if it's something that they are struggling with, what happens when they struggle? They become disengaged. And when they become disengaged, they're not really learning. So it's important to be selecting the appropriate tools and resources. You also must be flexible too. You and I both know that as teachers, we can plan and plan and plan, but then something happens and we need to be able to change on the fly. We think students understand a concept, but they really don't. And so you need to go backwards before you can go forwards. And when it comes to planning, it's important to have clear expectations. Students need to know what's expected of them. And again, this all comes out in the planning of the unit. When you're planning the unit, you need to make sure that you are having engaged tasks for the students to do. And to get there, they need to understand what they're supposed to be doing. One of the things I like in the book is that it kind of breaks down a few different sections for this idea of planning your unit and thinking about different ways students learn. They've got this really cool picture of a pinwheel on page 125, where in the center of the pinwheel, it says purpose. Like, what is their purpose? And then there's four spokes to that windmill. One is demonstrating, collaborating, coaching and facilitating, that's three, and the last one is practicing. And the way the book breaks it up is that they go into each one of these, they call them blades. They talk about what each of those looks like. Distance learning, but I think it still applies when we are talking about in-person learning. So the first blade that they talk about is this idea of demonstration. Now, what I love that they pointed out is that demonstration does not mean the teacher always doing the demonstrating. You have a classroom full of students. I guarantee that there are some students in there that might be able to demonstrate for their classmates on what you're trying to get them to accomplish. And so you need to pull them into it, because when you're pulling students in, when students are learning from other students, they tend to be more engaged. That's the whole idea behind collaboration. And so if you have a student who is demonstrating, then you are going to have them engaged. And you're also going to have the students that they are teaching also engaged. One of the tools that they talk about using for demonstrating is this idea of think-alongs. And I know I did this a lot, especially when I was teaching reading, was saying to the students, I'm going to think out loud right now. And then I kind of talk through the thinking. So their idea of think-along, there's 7 points that they use. One is naming the strategy, skill, or task. State the purpose of the strategy, skill, or task. And one of the things that they point for that one is they say good speakers who are giving a speech will often repeat a key idea or two again and again, and it makes the message stick. So the idea of repetition, when we hear things more than one time, it tends to stick. Think about when you're meeting somebody. I always remember being told, if you use their name 3 times in that first introduction, you are more likely to remember their name. You're going to explain why the strategy or skill will be used, use analogies to link prior learning to the new learning, being able to help students connect one thing to another, alert learners to errors to avoid, and assess the use of that skill. Now, there are a few other things in that section, but I'm going to have you go ahead and look at them yourselves. I don't think they are as important when it comes to learning in person, but if you are remote, there are some good things to look at, like the idea of your lectures and shared sessions. I like how in the shared sessions one, they actually had students get provided a home delivery of supplies to cook alongside the teacher. And that kind of helps with the nutrition engagement. The next blade is the collaboration blade. Well, we all know what collaboration looks like, working together. But for a few specific ideas, one that I did a lot was this idea of book clubs, where And I would go back to that model of a tic-tac-toe board where students would have, for their book clubs, people would rotate through different jobs in the club, and then they would have discussions that the discussion director would do. I think that's even what the book notes too, is using a discussion director for the book club to talk about it. And then when you as a teacher show up, you engage with the students about what they were talking about in that book club. Another approach that I like to do with collaboration is the idea of a jigsaw. When you think of a jigsaw, I always think of a puzzle. And so students work together to bring their knowledge together to create a greater understanding. And in this collaboration section there, I really like on page 139, they have this strategy that I definitely would have used if I was teaching still in person, which is the tag strategy. Tell the writer something you like, ask the writer a question, give the writer a suggestion. I think that would be a really cool strategy on working with students and their writing when the students are working together. Because I always used to do a speed dating, but writing. So students would share their writing with another classmate. The classmates would, what I had them do at least, was three positives and one thing you're wondering about. And the students would then take all those notes from the speed dating day, and then they would go back the next day and continue to revise and edit and make their writing the strongest that it could be. I think this tag idea is another similar way. It's three specific questions. And so I don't know, I always liked the 3-in-1 model. The next section of Module 7 is a little bit on the shorter side, and that's the coaching and facilitating. And all this makes me really think of is, how are you scaffolding your learning for your students? Because that is important, because not every student learns the same way. Not every student gets whatever you're trying to get at the same path. For some students, it's a more of a meandering path to get to that final understanding. And as a coach, as the teacher, you are a coach. You are coaching them along in their learning because you're not doing it for them. They are doing the learning themselves. And the last blade is even shorter than the other three, and that's the idea of practicing. Well, if you've ever played a sport, you know what it means to practice. You do the same thing repetitively till you get really, really good at it. And the same thing applies here. It's important to have deliberate practice, but we need to counter the idea that practice is mindless repetition. Students have to focus their attention and engagement to the tasks with a specific goal of improving their performance. That's what it means to practice, not just do the same thing over and over again, like you're working on a railroad all your livelong day. Deliberate practice is developing a mental representation. A mental representation is like a really well-developed model of how the world should work, according to the authors here. And so when it comes to thinking about your unit plans, it's important to design your learning experiences and thinking about every aspect of that experience for those students. There are so many different strategies. We've only just barely touched the surface on them. And as you can see, if you were to read the book, there's a lot of different things that you can do to help you stay organized and meet the needs of your students. And like all the sections, I like to end on that success criteria. I can identify high leverage instructional strategies that are likely to impact the students' learnings. I can adjust instructional experiences when students are not learning. I can demonstrate necessary aspects of learning for the students. I can design collaborative tasks that are appropriately challenging. I can coach and facilitate students' learning based on the needs that have been identified. And I can design practice that is both spaced and deliberate. In thinking about engaging tasks and the planning for the instructional units, I think all these things really come back together that you need your plans to work together. Students need to trust that you have their best intentions in mind. By giving them effective feedback, by planning backwards, you will help your students be successful in the classroom. So it's important to consider all the individual needs of your students and it's very important to remain flexible. So that was a lot to cover, and you know what, I probably could have broken it up between, but I really felt like those two things really went together well. The idea of planning your units and having engaging tasks. Because when you're planning your units, you need to have those engaging tasks. If I were the authors of the book, I might have actually have flipped these two modules in their order, because having that idea of backwards planning and planning for students to understand, you need to know what you want your students to do, and then you start working on the tasks that get them there. So over the next 2 weeks, we're gonna cover module 8 and module 9. Module 8's all about feedback, assessment, and grading, everyone's favorite topics. And then module 9 actually is all about pulling it all together. And this is where I really got that idea that this book is not just for distance learning, but it is for learning of any kind. And so we'll talk about those two things in the next couple of weeks. As summer is wrapping up, I hope you're getting the rest that you need. I hope that you have gotten this book. And if you haven't, there's a link that I don't get any money for, but it is a link for you to buy the book. Last I saw, the book was like $6. So if you got $6 to spare, instead of going and getting that Starbucks coffee, because their prices have gone up way too much, go and get this book instead, because I think there's a lot of great materials here for you to use in the classroom. So thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of the SBS Digital Learning Hour, I'd love for your support of the podcast. Please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. Head over to your favorite podcast platform. I prefer Spotify myself, but there's also iTunes, and I was going to say Stitcher, but Stitcher is leaving us at some point soon. I don't even know if it'll be available on Stitcher by the time we listen to this podcast. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me out on Instagram, Twitter, and my website, beardedtechedguy.com. You can find me also on the MySBS Digital Learning page, where we're posting regularly. And I do want to point out that we have a lot of great training opportunities coming up here in Springfield, so keep your eye out on TeachPoint. If you are not from Springfield and you are listening to us, I actually will be presenting at MassQ this coming October. I've got 3 different sessions that I'm doing on various things that we are doing here inside of Springfield Public Schools that I am a part of. Micro learning and badging. We have this podcast and how it is useful. And then, of course, I can never get away from a conference without presenting on Microsoft tools, because I think they are the best. Sign up to go to MassQ. It's sometime in October. I don't have the official dates right in front of me. All I know is I'm presenting at it, and I am super excited to do it. I am Mike Thomas, the Bearded Tech Ed Guy, and this is the SBS Digital Learning Hour.